Hello, welcome to this week's Opening Bell. I'm Boxing News editor Tris Dixon, joined as always by Matt Christie. John Dennon has been fired for his poor use of the sound equipment last week. Apologies for those of you who had trouble listening in last week. It actually wasn't John's fault, nor has he been fired. But we do have a sound technician working on last week's episode. So if you want to try and download it again, then hopefully there will be a new version up there. As mentioned, here joined by Matt Christie. Matt, you're about to head somewhere, aren't you?
I am. I'm New York bound.
So despite all those hashtag Texases I received, you're heading to New York. But you're excited about it, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm really excited. It was, you know, without going into too much detail, it was a case of money, really. Texas was a more expensive trip than New York. But yeah, I'm really, really excited. I think you can make an argument that Malinaji Judah could be a stinker. But I do think at this stage of their career, I think with Brooklyn Pride in place, I think it makes for an entertaining fight. And the bill's pretty good as well. There's some other good fights on the bill.
Looking forward to getting in out there in the cold.
I'm not. I don't relish the cold. But I'm hoping the whole romance of New York at Christmas time will warm my cockles.
Taking a supply of hats, because let's face
it,
the hair situation doesn't really help you out in the cold, does it?
No, people really don't understand what it's like to have no hair in cold weather. It can be quite uncomfortable. When I went to Helsinki, I think it was 2 years ago.
Chisora Helenius.
Yeah. I bought a rather extravagant fur hat, which is hideous. However, it kept my head warm.
Is that a Bolshevik style hat?
Yeah, it's horrible. Oh, nice. Yeah, it's horrible. But I'm going to be wearing that. The Del Boy style coat that I had has since bit the dust, I'm afraid. But yeah, as long as the head's warm, the rest of my body can generally cope.
Okay, right, that's exactly what people tuned in to hear. So without any more delay, let's get straight to the action from last week. And in Quebec, where Bob Mee was covering the fights for us, he saw Adonis Stevenson stop Tony Bellew in what was really a fairly one-sided fight. Any surprises there for you, Matt? Because last week you were saying you had a hunch about Bellew.
Yeah, I did. I did have a hunch that not necessarily that he'd win, just that he'd surprise a few people. And I was not surprised, but I thought that it wouldn't be as one-sided a fight as that. I think a lot of my reasoning for it was that I wasn't sold on Adonis Stevenson. In that, you know, you could make an argument that he caught Chad Dawson cold, that Tavoris Cloud was damaged goods. And I hadn't been that impressed with Stevenson when I'd seen him earlier in his career. But he looks the goods, and yeah, now I'm sold on him. He's a light heavyweight to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I mean, Stevenson called out afterwards Carl Froch and Bernard Hopkins. Either of them, do you think he can tempt either of them into fights?
I can't imagine Froch being that tempted, to be honest. Hopkins perhaps might fancy his chances. It's the kind of fighter that Hopkins has exposed in the past.
Political issues there, though, aren't there? Hopkins.
That's the thing, isn't
Golden
it?
Golden Boy and Stevenson. On
that's
HBO.
The thing. That's the thing. But I mean, we know what fight we want to see, which is against Kovalev, and you sense that with them both being on the same bill, this was kind of an appetizer for that main course, Kovalev Stevenson. But you do sense, and it's. Shame to say it, but you do sense it's not going to happen in the immediate future.
You sense, from the quotes from Stevenson, you sense a reluctance, don't you, to fight Kovalev?
Yeah, and you can't blame him, to be perfectly frank. You know, Kovalev's like a monster, isn't he?
Hang on, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, sorry, let's just go back to the actual fight, Bellew-Stevenson.
Yep.
You say that you now rate Stevenson, or he's more highly than you did beforehand. What impressed you about what he did on Saturday night?
We knew he had the power. Manny Steward was saying for years that he's one of the hardest punchers that he'd ever trained and everything else. We knew he had that. But he showed a few of the levels to his game. There was some patience there. There was some really nice boxing skill that I wasn't aware that he had. And he's got a ring intelligence as well. He knew exactly how to deal with Bellew. Bellew didn't look a threat at any point in the fight. Not for 1 second, really, did Bellew look like he was going to score the upset. Stevenson basically is not the one-dimensional banger that I thought he was.
I think Belly really tried to put it on him in round four, just without success. And I think that's where Stevenson impressed me the most, really, was when Belly seemed to be at his most aggressive, is that Stevenson didn't really try and put it on him there and then, but he evaded all the shots.
Yeah.
And I think defensively, he looked far superior than I thought he would do. I'm not saying Bellew was really applying massive pressure, but he couldn't hit Stevenson. I think that's one of the things Tony said that afterwards, that he found it he was harder to hit than he thought he would be, and that impressed me with Stevenson. It really did.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think he's developing, and
at a mature age.
Exactly,
as well.
He's 36, isn't he? Yeah. He's 36, so. You know, you wonder how much longer he's going to be at this level. If he's at his peak now, and people don't generally reach their peak at 36, but you sense that he's at his peak. So that's exactly why I'd like to see him in the big fights now.
If I was a professional fighter, and let's face it, I know it was never really that close, but if I was a professional fighter, one of the guys I would least like to fight is Sergey Kovalev.
Yeah.
What I think astonishes me about Kovalev is that I'm not sure I've seen him hit anyone clean yet. And when I say that, you know, you see those like eye-catching shots where, you know, like Tyson did in his heyday when he was sort of catching people and sort of bingoing them up against the ropes and down to the floor and sort of catapulting them from one side of the ring to the other. And you sort of see the shots land flush in the face and stuff. With Kovalev, he seems to graze past people, or hit them in the shoulders, or clump them in the arms, or on the side of the head, or on the top of the head, and they just crumble.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like the guy's just bashing down a wall, walking straight through people, and he doesn't seem to put any real leverage in his shots.
No,
he sort of walks forward, seems to be the same pace, seems to be the same power in each shot, and no one can survive. I mean, it's quite an awesome thing to watch, isn't it?
It really is frightening. It really, really is frightening. And you say all that, you're exactly right. You can understand why Nathan Cleverley, for example, thought, right, all I've got to do...
box circles around.
Yeah, and I'll take this guy into later rounds. Yeah, he's one-dimensional, everything. You can see why opponents will think that. But he's like an assassin in there. He's like an assassin. But you do... Again, he's done this to... But he's on a good run of form now. And he has done it to several opponents now. He's just demolished them, and it's a good level. But you wouldn't, you know. I remember when Gennady Golovkin was knocking, and when he knocked out Macklin, and then of course everybody's like, "Well, Gennady Golovkin is the most feared fighter in boxing."
Mm.
And then Curtis Stevens went eight rounds with him. So I wonder if Kovalev is going to encounter that kind of test where he has to go a few rounds, be exposed to an extent. And then, you know, maybe he's not this destroyer. Sure, yeah.
I think what's interesting, like I said, the thing that makes me think he is a destroyer is that I still haven't seen him really hit someone clean.
Yeah, I know.
You know, with a proper wind up shot. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's that leaves the impression that there's sort of margin that if he steps up, when he steps up the level of opposition, he'll be able to step up his level of performance. But I think you've hit a nail on the head there, really. One of the things that's surprising really is he looks like he could be a one-dimensional plodder in some respects, but there's so many facets to his game. We know obviously that the Eastern Europeans have produced some real talent through the amateur ranks and now the paid code, and he's one of them, because Ismail Siliak is no mug, is he? And he's just been wiped out.
I know
I think the question that many people have with Kovalev isn't who can beat him, but who's actually going to get some rounds out of him too?
Well, that's it. I mean, to me though, this Stevenson Kovalev fight, it should be made.
It's one of the most attractive in the sport now, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't think of a more attractive one off the top of my head. Perhaps some welterweight matchups, maybe. But I mean, I was thinking about it the other day, and the light heavyweight division has struggled for a while for attractive matchups, at least. And you can perhaps say go back to like Virgil Hill, maybe Michael Mora was a mouth-watering matchup that never happened. But it's not the same level as this. You go back to the 80s and your kind of your favourite era, late 70s, light heavyweights and what have you. There's some great matchups going on then, and I think you have to go back that far to get a matchup as appealing as this one.
I think part of the reason the late 70s was so appealing was you had so many sort of warmongers around there. Marvin Johnson, Matthew Saad Mohammed, Eddie Mustaf Mohammed, obviously the emergence of Michael Spinks.
Yeah.
Dwight Mohammed Cowie was coming in early 80s. And there was a whole cluster of guys. Obviously, John Conte, was a superb fighter from Liverpool. The talent pool was massive and it was deep. James Scott obviously fighting in prison, and there was so much going for it. And here, I think part of the reason why it's been short of that sort of thing really since Joe Calzaghe retired is obviously Roy Jones hit a peak and fell over the other side of the hill. You had Calzaghe called it a day. Chad Dawson never lit up the division, as people thought he might do with his skills, but he was sort of always frustrating and flattered to deceive a little bit. And obviously Bernard Hopkins has been at the top of the pile now for a while, and there's many good things that you can say about Bernard Hopkins, but he doesn't always give excitement. And here now at the top of the light heavyweight division, factoring out Hopkins, who's with Showtime, you have two top guys who like to fight and who are massive punchers. Arguably two of the top 10 punchers in the sport today, possibly even top five. And it's a natural fight. And this is the sort of fight where if HBO are serious about making great fights with the budget they've got, they will make sure that there's nowhere else for Kovalev or Stevenson to go but to fight each other.
Let's hope so. Yeah.
And let's hope, hey, if it's a great fight, let's do it again.
Exactly.
So, but we'll see. Elsewhere this week, Matt, veterans in action. Antonio Tarver defeating Mike Shepard in the USA, and down under, Shane Mosley losing to Anthony Mundine in Australia. What do you make of Mosley Mundine?
I didn't enjoy watching it, really. It was quite depressing. Mosley, typically a faded, gifted fighter, just chasing shadows. Knew what he wanted to do, couldn't do it. Didn't really have any success. I seem to remember him landing a nice shot maybe in the third round. He was in distress. No, he was in distress with an injury. He looked like a genuine injury. But it's sad to see, but these guys, I think you made the comment, that they will, that they've got to do this now. They've got to do it for the money. It's the only way that they know to earn money. And you can't, who are we to sit here and say, retire, when we're getting a paycheck at the end of the month? Shane Mosley has been boxing all his life. He doesn't know how else to make money. It's the only way he can make the money he's been used to. So who are we to say, walk away from that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just sad, isn't it? On the week where his contemporaries, Felix Trinidad and Oscar De La Hoya, should be inducted into a Hall of Fame 5 years after retiring, Mosley's plugging away, losing to guys that he would have beaten in his prime.
Yeah. It happens throughout history, doesn't it? I think the problem is with Sugar Ray Robinson, to an extent, I don't think his legacy was harmed by the fact that he fought on for so long, but he wasn't really fighting the top guys. He wasn't embarrassing himself at the end there. He was still giving a good exhibition of the good old days. It wasn't so depressing to watch as it seems to be with the likes of Shane Mosley. Mundine is you could make a case for him being a world-class fighter. But he's not. He shouldn't. Shane Mosley shouldn't be losing to people like Anthony Mundine.
No. I think obviously the telltale things about Mosley was that he's a mercenary. He's strictly in it for the money.
Yeah.
And I think when you're in it strictly for the money, it's the thing, bad things or sad things happen, really. Mm. And that's exactly about what happened in Australia. What to me showed, the argument of where he flew away from Australia and then flew back to Australia for the fight in the lead up to the fight. I mean, I can't think of too many worse preparations than that,
no,
to be honest.
No.
But told me sort of everything I needed to know, sadly, about that fight. Elsewhere in London at the Copper Box, Derek Chisora, fourth consecutive stoppage victory, puts him in an interesting position going into 2014. You spoke to him yesterday, and what was the tenor of the conversation?
He's positive. He's very positive. He's obviously come from. I remember speaking to him at the end of last year, and he wasn't even sure if he was going to fight. He was kind of saying things like, okay, I'm not a puncher, I don't hit as hard. And it's because that he'd had such a run of fights, he hadn't knocked anybody out, he'd been stopped by David Hay, various things were going against him. He had no motivation for the sport. So what he's done this year I find very, very impressive, particularly with someone who I always deem to have quite a fragile state of mind, really. And what he's done this year is very impressive, particularly, which is what he was talking about yesterday, when you consider that he lost one of his leaders in life, in Dean Powell, and that came along in September, 2 weeks after that, or in fact less than 2 weeks, Chisora was in the ring and winning the European heavyweight title, which is testament to a newfound strength of mind, I think, for Derek Chisora. I'm not saying he's going to go on and win a world title, but I think we can now mention him as a world contender.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think he's been a world contender really since he beat but didn't get the decision against Robert Hellenius, and badly exposed Hellenius for my money, someone who had a lot of hype about him, but he got the benefit of a decision over there in Finland in that freezing week when you were forced to buy that Russian Bolshevik hat. I've got to say, I haven't seen the Copperbox show yet. I've hadn't had much change out of 18-hour days this week, so I'm going to watch it on Friday. But I understand the Bradley Skeet Colin Lyons fight was watchable.
It was decent. Yeah, it was. It was certainly the best fight of the stuff that I saw. Skeet recovered from a knockdown early on. Even then, he still looked in control. But it was a competitive fight, enjoyable. The rest of the bill, though, I must say, it was a disappointment for me.
Okay, I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
Good advert. Okay. We got a feature this week with George Groves, who for many is the man of the moment in boxing at the moment. Very bold claims about a Carl Froch rematch. Looking at the healing of George Groves, really. You can download the current issue at www.boxingnewsonline.net/apps. Some good pictures of Groves as he is now showing his battle scars. And we've also got an interesting interview with James DeGale with his two cents on what happened between Groves and Froch. Obviously, he's quite well placed to be discussing it. But this weekend is another big one in the sport. And you know what? I think we're going to start somewhere off the beaten track.
Okay.
There's a lot of big shows going along. A lot of headlines going to be on the likes of ESPN and those the really big sites. But one fight that, for me, is going under the radar a little bit is the clash between Derry Matthews, who is surely one of the best value for money fighters in the country today, who's fighting Irishman Stephen Ormond, who we've both seen a bit of and both like the look of. And it looks like it could be a terrific fight in Liverpool, doesn't it?
It really does. After the hard career that Derry Matthews has had, and he's had quite a hard year as well. He's been in some absolute belters. I mean, you could make a case for his outings this year being the best British fights of the year. I'm surprised he's going in with somebody like Stephen Ormond, because Derry Matthews is almost, we're waiting for that fairy tale end or that fairy tale opportunity. And Ormond really, really is a threat to finish Matthews' career.
Because Derry's a guy who has won fights he should have lost and lost fights he should have won. Yeah. Going into this is a fight he should win.
Yeah, he should do. He should do. For me, though, I think Ormond is going to give him so, so much trouble.
Why it's so appealing. Obviously, Derry showed that you can never count him out against Tommy Coyle with that devastating finish earlier in the year in one of the best British fights of the year.
Yeah.
I think a fight that didn't quite, but very almost, have me leaping out of my chair. It's been a long time since a fight had me leaping out of my chair.
Yeah.
It might have been the... when was it? Might have been the second fight, Pacquiao Marquez with the knockdown.
Right. Chavez Martinez, last round?
No, do you know what? I was in my chair, but I was thoroughly enjoying it. I think that's what happened. But I knew the result of the fight before. I didn't know what happened at the end. I didn't know that there was a big last-ditch scramble from Chavez to turn it around. But I knew that Martinez survived.
You knew you'd hear the
final bell. I was watching that fight. I was watching the rerun thinking, did I read that result right? How does he make it out of this? So, but on that good Liverpool bill, we've got Liam Smith against Mark Thompson too, and it's another interesting fight because Mark Thompson's pushed a lot of good fighters very hard, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how his layoff has affected him. Probably, cause he was another thriller minute fighter, wasn't he, a few years ago. I think Smith, for me, this isn't as good a matchup as the main event. I think Smith, I think they're going in different directions at the moment. But
in
it's
which
certainly
case,
it's
you
a good
often
test
fancy
for Smith.
The man on the way up, don't you?
It's a good, test though for Liam Smith. It's a good British title fight.
And then Enzo Macconelli, your favourite. Oh. Against Courtney Frye. Now, I say that it's a bit of an in-joke, isn't it, us and Enzo? You were there at the night he fought Frenkel, and I was there at the nights he fought Frenkel, Afolabi and Lebedev.
Yeah.
So I've seen the horrendous knockouts from Matt Cronelli. On a more positive note, it's probably the most devastating stoppage I've seen ringside this year when he beat Oval McKenzie in their rematch. Where the shots had just emptied McKenzie's tank, and although he was still standing, he was out on his feet. So Matt Cronelli still shows he's got that punch, and he's in against serial underachiever, I hope he doesn't mind me saying, Courtney Frye, who turned pro, having gone to the Olympics in Sydney with Audley Harrison in a boxing team of two. Frye, we thought he beat actually an old amateur teammate of mine back in the amateurs in the ABA finals, Vince Jones. Courtney, we thought he'd do more than he has as a pro. Hasn't really worked for him. This is his chance to win the Commonwealth title, though. So he could. Do you fancy his chances?
Yeah, I don't. I feel like I'm being rude to Macronelli because he's at that stage of his career. He has taken those beatings. I don't think the McKenzie war was a great fight to watch, but I don't think that will do Enzo's longevity any favours. But I mean, what I was going to say is that almost anybody that Macronelli fights now, you give them a chance, whoever he's fighting. Which, you know, please don't think I'm being disrespectful for Macronelli for what he's achieved. He's a wonderful, exciting fighter
to
watch.
Well, let's not forget Shane McPhilbin, who's an average guy.
That was the thing. I was ringside for that as well, and it really looked like Macronelli was going to get stopped. There was that controversy with the short round and everything else. And, you know, at that point, I just thought, I haven't spoke to Enzo for a while now, but in the lead up to his comeback, I'd spoke to him and he was talking about his family and what have you. And then seeing him take so much punishment in the ring, you fear that the worst may happen with Enzo.
It's not an easy fight to call because you don't know exactly what Macronello's got left. But what do you think for him and Frye? How do you see it going?
I'd pick Macronelli. I would pick Macronelli.
Stoppage?
I'd pick him to stop him. I think Frye, for whatever reason, like you say, hasn't worked out for him. He's a exceptional boxer, but some guys, they just don't. It doesn't work for them in the professional game. Whether his heart's not in it, he announced his retirement a few years ago. This is a good opportunity for him. I anticipate it'll be a decent enough fight, but I would say that by halfway, Macronelli will win.
Okay, also looking forward to seeing British and Commonwealth super flyweight champion Paul Butler, who's fighting Mexican Ruben Montoya. And there's a big show in Atlantic City that night, topped by Guillermo Rigondo, one of the best fighters in the business, who's up against Joseph Agbiko, Ghanaian hard man. Agbiko, he's a bit of a Sacco Beaker, isn't there, about Agbiko? And that he'll give everyone a hard fight. And sort of, you know, you can imagine, it's very rare you can imagine anyone coming out of a fight with Agbiko without a busted nose and black eyes and swollen lips and all the rest of it. Whatever's hitting, whether it's a head or hands or anything.
Yeah, I was surprised with this matchup, to be honest with you, particularly with all the fuss around that nobody wants to fight Rigondo and they're struggling to get an appealing matchup for him. Of all the guys that they could have picked, I'm surprised they've got Agbiko in there. But, you know, I mean, I personally can sit there and watch Rigondo do his stuff round after round after round and fully appreciate it. I understand it from certain fans' point of view that it isn't the thriller minute stuff that they want to see. But Rigondo, for me, is one of the best fighters on the planet. Pound for pound, put him in the top five.
Top five?
Top five, yeah, I would, yeah. Okay.
Fair enough.
More on ability than what he's actually done there. But he took Nonito Donaire to school. I don't care what the scorecards were saying.
Okay, interesting stuff. Big Bill in Atlantic City sees Matthew Macklin return against Lamar Russ. And there's a really interesting fight. For me, I really like the look of James Kirkland against Glenn Tapia.
Yeah.
Tapia, the prospect from New Jersey, managed by Pat Lynch, who was the career manager of Arturo Gatti. Looks like a very, very solid prospect. Let's hope he's got a chin, though.
Yeah, well, it's the acid test, isn't it? It's the acid test. And I'm sure that Kirkland... And we were saying similar things about Kirkland, and we found out he didn't seem to have one, or he's not the most durable guy. The thing is, he's been out for such a long time, though, hasn't he, Kirkland? His problems outside the ring is no secret. But to me, that's a really, really interesting matchup.
Fascinating fight, and Matthew Macklin can't afford to slip up. There's talk of him fighting Andy Lee in February in Dublin. Last I heard, that talk quietened down somewhat. But with Martin Murray and Darren Barker both fighting within a 7-day spell, if Macklin's going to be mentioned alongside those guys in 2014, it's so important he doesn't stumble on Saturday night.
Yeah, it really is. He's getting to that point for his career now where it is make or break, where another loss would really see him struggle to kind of get back to where he wants to be. So it is an absolute must-win for Matthew Macklin.
Now, as we've mentioned, you're off to Brooklyn this weekend. And, you know, as far as Cheeky Five is going, I think providing I remember to get down, and I don't gamble, there's part of me that thinks I need to put a Cheeky Fiver on a draw double here for the two main events, or the co-main events, Malinaji Judah and Trout and Lara.
Yeah.
I think they're really hard to pick fights, and yeah. I think they're both going to be exceptionally close. I don't think they're not only hard to pick, but I think whoever wins, I think they're going to be close fights.
Yeah, I definitely got my backing on that Cheeky Fiver there. Do it. No, as you say, I think Judah Malinaji is more like, for me, that's going to be. That's almost impossible to call that fight for me.
What wins it for Malinaji if he wins?
I think he's the fresher fighter. I think he showed against Broner he's still got... He hasn't had the punishing fights that Judah's been in. And I just think he's a little less likely to make mistakes than Zab Judah.
I don't know.
And he can go... He'll go for his stamina as well, I would pick over Judah.
Yeah, I mean, Paulie has proven to be a 12-round fighter in the past, whereas Judah, you know, people say that he does toil down the stretch. You think of the fights with Cotto and some of the other clashes where he hasn't looked the same fighter going into the second half. Malinaji, I think what... And he sort of showed it against Broner, but I think Broner struck a nerve with him that you were going to get the best that Malinaji had to offer against Broner with how ill-tempered and how cringeworthy their build-up to the fight was. Again, the thing with Malinaji, I wonder if the hunger's there. We've interviewed him numerous times for the magazine where he's clearly not passionate about the sport any longer, certainly the political side of it. And you wonder if the desire's there in a hard fight, if he's not just going to cash out at some point and say, that's it, I've had my lot. You know, he's got the Showtime gig, which he's obviously very good at and doing very well with. So just makes me wonder if the fight gets really hard, who's going to want it less? Not who's going to want more.
Yeah,
Judah down the stretch or Malinaji might have his eyes on other areas of the sport.
I hear you. And I think if the fight was anywhere else other than Brooklyn, that would be a concern for me as well. But I just think that for both of these guys, fighting in this new arena in Brooklyn is going to be a massive deal, and however hard it gets for either of them, they're going to fight for as long as they possibly can. I really believe that, because it's a huge, huge deal for Brooklyn to have this fight, and neither of those guys will, because effectively the loser has got nowhere to go. They will not want to have that quite sorry punctuation mark on their careers taking place in their hometown.
Yeah, sure, fair enough. Can Judah stop Malinaji?
Yeah, if it's going to be a stoppage, you'd have to favour Judah. He's a good puncher, really, really, really good puncher. But he's not the fighter he was. He's not the fighter he was.
Well, I remember when Judah was coming up, there was a lot of talk, really. He was basically going to do what Mayweather's done, really,
yeah.
Wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I remember that. And, he was walking the walk until he walked straight into Costa Zoo, wasn't he? And then, you know, you look back on that, and he hasn't really... He had that spell where he beat Corey Spinks. He got revenge for Corey Spinks. I think he stopped him in 9 rounds, and that was when Spinks was at the top of his game, and then you thought Judah may go on to do something. And let's not forget the trouble he gave in 2000. Was it 2005, 2006? Mayweather, for the first four rounds, they're four of the toughest rounds of Mayweather's career. You can make a case that he dropped him. It looked like Mayweather's glove touched down. But he hasn't quite fulfilled that potential. He's had a fantastic career. He's won titles in two weight divisions. But the potential that was there, he didn't quite live up to it for me.
Okay, Trout Lara on that bill, Matt. Really interesting. Lara has won a couple of fights and not got the decisions. Trout fought in front of 40,000 people earlier in the year against Sal Alvarez. And came up short in the fight that obviously stamped Alvarez's golden ticket for the Mayweather fight. Lara, conversely, by the way, was in one of the best fights of the year.
Yeah.
Against Angulo.
Yeah.
And you know, they've both had telling years, but they can end it on a real high, can't they?
Yeah. This is a good fight. This is a good fight. It may not be that pleasing on the eye, but as a matchup in terms of where the winner goes, it's a really, really good fight. And again, yeah, I can see why you think this might be a draw as well.
All southpaw draw.
Yeah, exactly.
Not often two southpaws get together to put on a great fight.
No, very, very rare. Very, very rare. But I, at the moment, I am really struggling to pick a winner out of Malinaji Judah. I'm struggling to pick a winner out of Trout Lara. And for me, that's why they are appealing fights. If you haven't got this preconception about who's going to win, it's a far more pleasing spectacle.
Yeah. on the bill, elsewhere on the bill, we've already mentioned him, Sakio Bika defending his title against Anthony Durrell. Devin Alexander up against Sean Porter. Do you see anything other than Alexander and Bika wins?
I give Durrell more of a shot than I would give Porter. Porter, quite heavily hyped prospect, exposed a little bit against Julio Diaz. I know he's reversed that draw since. But as for Bika, Anthony Durrell, he's not as good as Andre, you would think. You know, from all the evidence that I've seen, he's not as good as his brother. But Bika, again, he's another one of these guys that you watch him and you think, yeah, I'll beat him. You can imagine that Durrell now is just licking his lips, thinking he's gonna
box circles
gonna win a lopsided decision.
Yeah, but Bika makes it so uncomfortable, doesn't he? So yeah. Uncomfortable for people. Look at the states or the faces of the people who fought him, Calzaghe, Ward. He's left their mark on all of them, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So interesting. I mean, you know, for four main fights on the bill, you can't go too wrong with that Brooklyn show.
No.
Same way that there's plenty to enjoy on the Atlantic City bill, but some really great fights coming up this weekend. If you could be ringside at one fight this weekend, where would you go? One fight.
One fight,
not one
as
bill,
opposed to one bill.
Fight.
Derry Matthews, probably.
Yeah. I think I like the idea of... Matthews Ormond for me, I think, will be the best fight. If you're in a, if you're neutral venue anywhere else, then I think that's the fight I'd like to see too.
Yeah.
But Tapia Kirkland, I think, will be really interesting as well. One fight we haven't mentioned yet, and I've spoken to Darren Barker this week, is his IBF middleweight title fight. Defense with Felix Sturm, Barker going on the road to defend his title in Germany. Do you give him credit for that? Or do you think, you know, it's just a business decision?
I think ultimately it's a business decision. I think it is. And, you know, kind of going back to what we were saying about Shane Mosley, these guys deserve to earn as much money as they can. And if Darren Barker's getting a handsome payday for this, which I'm sure he is, then why not? It's not a ridiculous decision to fight Felix Sturm in Germany. Felix Sturm, you would think, is past his best, and it's certainly it's more than winnable for Darren Barker. But you're obviously concerned about judging over there and that sort of thing, which is an age old concern, and I don't think it is the real fear that it used to be. But you have got to take it into consideration when you're considering this fight.
Well, Barker will look at the form line, won't he, and see that he beat Gill, who beat Sturm. I think, therefore, he can beat the man who the man beat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Doesn't always work that way, though, does it? But absolutely, I think, head on the block, I'd pick Barker to win.
I think style-wise, though, where Barker's not a one-punch hitter, you can see it going the distance. And in that case, you can see it being a very close, tight and hard-fought fight, because Sturm's team, as we know, has pushed the boat out financially to get Barker there. So there's every chance that they know that this is going to be the last chance saloon for Sturm to get a world title.
Yeah, exactly. And guys like Felix Sturm, you do very often see that they do have one fantastic effort left in them, don't they? Sturm hasn't shown me that he's that far past his best that he's shot or anything along those lines. So he may have that one last, you know, wonderful performance in him and take the title.
With that final thought, we'll leave you until next week.